WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Today we'll hear an interview with a doctor from Tampa General Hospital where we talk about the important questions people have about the coronavirus pandemic in Florida. And right here in the Tampa Bay area, you'll hear about things to consider during the debates about whether to return to in-person classrooms. We'll also talk about how the coronavirus numbers are trending and whether there's a chance we could gain herd immunity to COVID-19. And then later in the show, I'll open up the phones to take your calls. In the meantime, you can email your questions or your comments to dj@wmnf.org, or you can text 813-433-0885. If you do text, please put your name on the text. Florida has recorded more than 6,000 coronavirus deaths during the pandemic. The state health department reported another 76 deaths today, bringing the number of people in Florida who've died of the coronavirus since March 1st to nearly 6,050. More than one-third of those who have died during July. The state recorded almost 8,900 new confirmed cases today, bringing the total to nearly 424,000, and the positivity rate for tests over the last 7 days is still 19%. That's about where it's been for the last 3 weeks, but that number is 6 times higher than it was 2 months ago, just before the number of cases began spiking, followed a few weeks later by the number of deaths. And this weekend, we found out that more people have been infected with coronavirus in Florida than in the state of New York. Florida surpassed New York over the weekend as the state with the second most coronavirus cases in the U.S. after California, which has about double Florida's population. So during this show, I'm going to try to find out what your reaction is to Florida having more cases of coronavirus than New York and Florida passing the threshold of 6,000 deaths. You're listening to WMNF Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan, and here we're going to start the show with an interview I recorded last week, and we'll take your calls after that. And this interview is with Jason Wilson, and Dr. Wilson is Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. You're listening to WMNF. Here's the interview.
Really, no matter what, at this point, we're going to hit the 2,000 per 100,000 cases, because New York City hit that after invoking safer at home orders and after invoking mask ordinances. As a matter of fact, if you go back in time and you look at around March 20th or so is when they really started to get very serious about these mask ordinances and these safer at home ordinances. That was about 5 days before their slope took off at the same acceleration as ours is right now. And so it took them from around late March into late April to finally bend their curve over and plateau at around 2,500 cases per 100,000 people. So we know that means that even once we really get serious about how we want to do public health interventions, we've got that much time before we're going to be able to bend the curve. You brought up the mask. That's a really good, I think, public health intervention to bring up. We're at a place right now where we're a few weeks out of the mask ordinances, both at the city, which was a few days before the county, and then the county EPG passed a mask ordinance in early July. So we should start to see some effect of those mask ordinances from late June, early July. And I think we are seeing those impacts. As a matter of fact, I think if you think about each public health intervention as being able to add a little bit of help, right, a little bit of assistance for you, then you can basically say, I think we might have gotten what we're going to get out of the masks. In other words, the mask probably helped us get that plateau point we've hit in Hillsborough County area, which is great. We had to take the foot off the accelerator before you even think about stopping. So we had to get there first, which is a great first step. And so now I think we've seen basically what masks are going to get us, which is we've plateaued a little bit. We're not accelerating up anymore. So the next question is going to be, well, how do we want to bend the curve down? Well, that's the question of debate, because I think there's sort of three things you have to think about here is, one, is there anything that we could be doing right now that we're not doing? Is there anything that we're about to do that we shouldn't do? And is there anything in terms of something we haven't even looked at yet that we should do? And so let me just walk through those quickly. So in terms of what should we be doing that we could be doing, I would say that's the bar ordinance enforcement. And so if you really look at the first week and a half of the Florida rollback of having bars open, it really took about a week and a half to 2 weeks before anybody got serious about enforcing that. So we've heard the co-owner of the Crowbar, a local establishment here, Tom DeGeorge, come out a couple of times and really ask for other bar owners and businesses to please listen and socially distance and not have, you know, dance type of party atmospheres in the bars, because it drags us out for all of us. And I was on with Mayor Castor a couple of weeks ago, and I brought the same point up, you know, that we're still seeing this, and brought up with the EPG as well. I know Mayor Castor, about 5 or 6 days ago from now, really started to get much more serious about enforcement of those bar openings. And so hopefully we'll see 2 weeks after that some changes that come from having those bars open. It takes about 2 weeks for any of these things to sort of show an impact. Another two things I'm sure we'll talk about in this conversation is a big decision that's coming up for Tampa and Hillsborough County, which is school reopenings. And this concept of having 24,000 staff and employees going back into a physical space, plus 100, it looks like about 106,000 kids right now have said they might come back into, or half of that, I'm sorry, 50, that's what we did, how we did the survey. It's about 50% of that 106,000 may be coming back in traditional brick and mortar schools. And then the third thing we might talk about as well is, do we have to consider any other type of public health interventions or rollbacks from phase two to phase one to further back?
And so far, we have only talked with Dr. Jason Wilson, the medical director of the clinical decision unit at Tampa General Hospital, about infection rates and the number of infections. But there's even some indicators that will lag behind those, such as number of hospitalizations, ICU bed availability, and deaths. How does Hillsborough County look on some of those?
Yeah, so one sliver of hope we have is that our case fatality rate has stayed very low. Now, we don't know if that's because we were able to plan and really keep ourselves from surging over to this capacity of ICUs and ventilators, and that might be part of the story, or is it because medical treatment has evolved since we saw New York City have very high capacity rates, or potentially more likely that we just know that epidemiological curve tends to lag behind two other curves. And that first curve we see is high volume of people presenting for testing. And it was something we hadn't seen before yet in Tampa area, where high volumes of young people who are asymptomatic, meaning they had no evidence of disease, recognizing they have been exposed to the virus somewhere, usually what we call kind of a super spreader event in a kind of a close-knit atmosphere. Really the ones we think of here have been restaurants, nightclubs, and closed box gyms, small sort of CrossFit gyms. That's where we've had some big super spreader event exposures. So once we started seeing those in around mid-June, that's when we started to see that high volume. And again, that volume was impressive. The volume really showed us that we had the possibility of becoming New York City really quickly. In an area that we set up underneath the emergency department ramps called the alternate care site, it was built to really decompress people who were just coming in for testing, people who were really just worried well or seeking testing because everything that's going on, sort of decompress and also keep people safe in the hospital as well. We went from about 15 to 20 people a day being tested in that area back in March to a day in June, where we saw over 300 people in that area. So suddenly this magnitude difference, this, you know, fivefold, tenfold difference in magnitude became possible and real. And so you can start to take those same numbers down and drop them down into whatever outcome you're concerned about, hospitalizations, ventilators, the number of deaths, and you start to see those same numbers kind of fall into place. So we know that if 300 people come to us for testing, and the prevalence, the number of people who are positive out of that total number of people who got tested, if that prevalence was almost 30%, which it was, almost 30%, we know that about 5 to 10% of those people are going to get sick, and they're going to be back in about a week. And we know that that overall number is good representation of about a 20% number of our community that's going to get very sick and get infected with the virus from those young super spreaders, and they're going to come into the hospital as well. It takes about 2 to 3 weeks to see that peak happen. And we did. We saw that. We've seen that BPG meetings where we really saw kind of high volumes of testing here in mid-June. And then we started seeing by early July, mid-July, our hospitalization rates really start to climb. You know, the easy number for me to kind of think about is in March, April, and May, on any given day, our census of COVID positive patients at our hospital was about 20, 15 to 20 patients at a given time. by this point in July, it's really more mid-60s at any given time. And so just extrapolate that up to the other hospitals, right? And these were now admitting, instead of 5 patients a day, we're admitting 15 to 20 to 25 patients a day. You're seeing admission rates, you know, overall, which are in the hundreds a day. So now we can start to see that peak as well happen. So then, of course, the other problem with COVID is that the length of stay, the time it takes for medical treatment, tends to be very long. And some of these courses of medical illness tend to be very long. And so for that reason, sometimes deaths don't occur until much later. Now, what we haven't had happen yet, and the thing I'm working all the time to try to avoid have happen, as we're, of course, the public can help us out as well, is for our systems to be overrun. And so even though our capacity is always having to kind of be recreated, try to build in more beds, we're still in a place in this entire area we've been able to kind of share the burden and kind of build in capacity. New York City got hit so quickly and so hard that they lost capacity overnight. And then you had COVID patients in curtain areas of the ER, in hallways of the ER. And you had people making very tough decisions about which person gets a ventilator, which person doesn't. We haven't gotten there yet. And so we're hoping that we can maintain this capacity issue in a way where we don't get overburdened, which will hopefully keep we will get a spike in case fatality. If we have more people who are sick, we're going to see case fatality rates go up. So we try to minimize how much that ceiling is when they go up by trying to buffer that surge.
How close are we to the capacity of the hospitals, of the ICU beds, of ventilators in Hillsborough County?
Yeah, it's a great question. And let me kind of talk through a couple of, I think, important planning points that we've done, which I think have helped out the citizens in this area really well. I think when it was recognized that leadership was going to have to come from the ground around COVID, I think some of our hospital leaders actually did a pretty good job of remembering why they got into healthcare to begin with and how the hospitals work together to build this Florida West Coast regional data exchange. And that regional data exchange is 51 different hospitals all put their data together every day. What's really nice about that is that it avoids a lot of the issues you're hearing about in terms of where we're putting data to, how that data is being shared back to us. We really are avoiding that because we have our own data that we share with each other and we can confirm it with each other. And I think that's really helped take a lot of the, you know, the politics or the differences and just how data is collected out of this equation for citizens here in this area, because we're really looking at our own data across 51 hospitals. And that's really helped us, I think. We have our own definitions of what an ICU bed is and what a ventilator means and what a length of stay on a ventilator means. And we all kind of speak the same language when we talk about that. And what that's allowed is, small little hospitals in our community that might have a 10-bed ER and 200 total beds. If we see that they're getting, you know, 4 or 5 COVID critical care patients, well, we know they're probably at their capacity. Look, even if they can build a couple more COVID beds in there, who's going to staff them, right? And so that's a big part of this equation too, is you've got to have really trained ICU nurses and respiratory therapists and other staff that can take care of very sick people who are undergoing essentially treatments that we have never seen before, right? I mean, it's not like, oh, here's a heart failure patient. I've done this 1,000 times in my career. This is a COVID patient. This is all brand new stuff. And so we're able to share those resources. And then I think at individual hospital space, you know, a place like Tampa General or any other big hospital in this community, what we're constantly doing is thinking about 3 things, I think, with capacity. Can we build and convert more physical capacity? Can we staff that capacity by redistributing resources into that capacity space? And then can we create capacity somewhere else? Can we create it either virtually, or can we create it by choosing to do something different on that day? And so, you know, when we think about physical space, that's something I think everyone is sort of looking at the numbers and constantly always thinking about, when do we convert another physical space for our COVID patients? And, you know, I would have, you know, listeners also, when they look at slides like the EPG slides, always look at that top number too, because what can become concerning or interesting very quickly is if the number of beds that we have available keeps on going up, but the percent occupied stays the same. Well, that really means, right, that the percent occupied really is much more concerning than it may look like on face value. And no one's trying to hide that. That's there in the slides. But just keep that in mind when you're interpreting that. And right now, there's been enough space that we can convert new spaces and we can, you know, put new HVAC systems in. This gets very complicated very quickly. You know, we we thought we had a perfect space one time in the hospital, and we were going to just open it up for COVID. And, one of our engineers said, well, that shares the same air take as the transplant unit, where the most immunocompromised patients we have are. Probably a good idea not to dump, this air into that space. And so, we've seen people remodel those spaces, and so we have to build this physical capacity in. And then when you do that, you've got new beds to staff, right? And so how do you staff those beds? You've got to take trained people and move them from doing one thing over to something different. And so at some point, the concern I have, even before we get to talking about numbers over the number of beds we have available, is what do you take away from the community by taking staff who do one thing every day and moving them to something different? Does that mean you have to decrease surgeries, which we've seen some hospitals do? Tampa General hasn't had to do that yet, but some hospitals have, because they just don't have enough staff to move those parts around. And so if you do a whole bunch of other elective surgeries, who's going to staff those patients in a PACU or another ICU? And so you start to kind of think about that part. And then I think the part that's been really innovative and probably won't go away, I think it'll be part of healthcare forever, is really how we virtually have created capacity. And what I mean by that is really thinking about, well, what can we offer you in the hospital? And look, if you need to be in the hospital, we're going to put you in the hospital. But, if you're a person who's got Zoom at home and an internet connection that works kind of, and you've got some capabilities to go home, and you maybe don't need a IV medication and you don't have to have oxygen right now, maybe we go home, we do Zoom meetings with you every day, telemedicine that's called. And telemedicine's really struggled to take off because of some payment issues and some other technology issues, but it sort of forced the hand now, and we're kind of there, and we're utilizing a lot of telemedicine. People go home with pulse oximeters, which are little devices you wear on the finger to measure oxygen. They're interacting with their own medical record more because they have to input some of those data points into the medical record for us. They're wearing almost like Apple Watch type of devices that measure all kinds of vital signs and things that we can even see change before the patient even recognizes that they may have a symptom change, and then we can see that monitored 24 hours a day and reach out to the patient. So we're creating all this capacity. Right now, there's still capacity in the system because we're doing so much work around creation of capacity. Again, I go back to the big question on the table is, if you plateau at 9 to 10,000 cases a day in the state of Florida, if you plateau at 45 to 50 cases per day in Hillsborough County, well, how long can you keep on creating the capacity to bring in those new admissions? Because you're running a deficit every day. What I mean by that is, the length of stay for COVID patients is so long. In the Hillsborough County EPG, a week and a half ago, the data point they showed was 12 days, which sounds about right. In this whole area, it was about 12 days length of stay. So length of stay is, and by the way, that's for some context for people, 12 days is unheard of in a hospital in 2020. That's like 1990s or 1980s kind of length of stays. You just don't see that anymore. Very sick patients transition into other types of units very quickly now. 3 to 4 days, even for sick people, is a much more common type of length of stay. So the question on the table is, how much can you keep on creating this virtual capacity, this real capacity, this staffing capacity, until eventually these little tiny waves erode the seashore?
Our guest is Dr. Jason Wilson, Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital, and you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint on 88.5 FM. Well, you posted online on LinkedIn your concerns about opening in-person schools, and you compared the number of cases in Hillsborough County to the number of cases in Denmark when Denmark reopened its schools. And the caseload in Hillsborough County right now is about 10 times what it was in Denmark. So why don't you talk people through that?
Sure. So I think the first thing to say anytime we have a school discussion is that I really want schools to reopen. I really want, look, I have an 11-year-old running around somewhere right now. I really like him to go off to school for a little while. That would be great, I think, for working parents. So no one is, teachers, doctors, public health officials, no one wants to do this forever. What I have really tried to advocate for is to do this at a time where it's safe and to not put decision-making on the responsibility of a parent at a time where data is A, concerning looking, and B, rapidly shifting. I always sort of make an analogy that I'm an ER doctor and I make decisions based on very little information that impacts people's lives all the time. And I struggled. It took me until about 11:59 p.m. to turn that form in, which was a declaration of intent is what it was called, turn the form in that said what I wanted my kid to do. And so if I was struggling that much with this, is, you know, much as I know about COVID and I have all the data at my fingertips, I can't imagine what other parents, you know, must have been going through and what our teachers and staff of those schools must be going through right now, because it was a very, very difficult decision to make right now. The hope here, of course, the thing we've talked about earlier in this conversation, is that if we can get to a plateau and bend it and start to see a decrease in those numbers, then this is a great conversation to have about how to reopen schools and what kind of resources that really takes. And I'm a huge public school supporter. My kid's in public school. I love public schools. But listen, our public schools don't have the resources to do the type of social distancing and public health interventions it's going to take to do this safely in the prevalence we're at right now. That's just the reality of where we are in this, you know, environment for public schools right now. Because if you look at other countries that have safely reopened schools, I actually saw something online with some photographs from Thailand. And these schools, I mean, it looked like the kid was walking into a phone booth at their desk. You know, big plastic barriers, about 8 kids in every classroom, you know, everyone with masks, you know, the teacher had a large barrier in front of her. The bathrooms have lots of, you know, hygiene products in them. And pre-pandemic on a given day, if you talk to your kid or any other, you know, classroom instructor or whatever, they're going to tell you that those things just aren't able to keep up with the demand normally. So then, you know, you think about the Scandinavian countries and people point out, well, they reopened safely. Maybe we can too. And so, you know, Denmark reopened. You brought up Denmark. And Denmark reopened in mid-April, around April 15th. And at the time that Denmark reopened, their prevalence was about 150 cases per 100,000. And they had really kind of, they flattened the curve. I mean, that's where they were at. So they essentially weren't really having new cases every day. I mean, they were having some, it was going down. They're in the 2 to 3 per 100,000 new case per day range. And just as a reminder, we're in the 45 to 50 new case per day range. We're only about a week out from having a 72 per 100,000 new case per day range. So just to give some perspective to that number, they were about 3 to 4 weeks into 1 to 3 new per 100,000 cases per day. So we're asking people to make decisions when things look vastly different than anything we have to compare it to. And so the big point of advocacy, I guess, that I have tried to make is that could we just delay this decision a bit so that we could see what's going to happen with our overall prevalence of cases so that people can make reasonable decisions. Unfortunately, my concern right now is the decisions you're going to see made are going to be decisions that are based off necessity, not off the best interests of our students. And so, you know, schools that have a lot of resources, maybe private schools, might be able to limit a classroom to 8 to 10 people, which is, you know, CDC guidelines, less than 10 people in any meeting space right now. But a public school, even with e-learning, the public schools are not going to be able to maintain small classroom sizes. We're still going to have very crowded classrooms, which are not conducive to social distancing and public health interventions. As a matter of fact, if you go back to what I said earlier, in terms of what do we think are the main spreader events for COVID, it's being in an indoor space close together for a long period of time. That sounds a lot like a classroom to me. And, you know, when you have a prevalence over 15%, I'm not sure if people recognize the mathematics of this, but if you have a prevalence over 15%, your risk that somebody in a room of 10 people having COVID is almost half. So you've got a coin flip chance that somebody else in that room probably has COVID. And, you know, if you get to the place where you have 100 people in the school, you're getting up to 75 to 80%. And 300 to 500 people, basically you have it. And someone's going to have it around you. And so, you know, these are very tough issues that we have to walk through. So not only are we asking parents and teachers to sort of make difficult decisions that I think are based on necessity. When I say necessity, of course, what I mean is there are some of our workforce who just simply don't have a choice. They have to go back out and work in a service industry or some other face-to-face type of industry. And they also may be parents who don't have resources to have some kind of, you know, home tutoring person or somebody to watch a kid do e-learning at home. And so what unfortunately that does is it reproduces a lot of other structural problems in our society, in our local area, where not only are these people who have to go back out to work without all the PPE I get to wear, they're going to go back out to work and have a higher risk of getting COVID themselves. And now their kid potentially also has that higher risk as well. And so we're kind of doubling down on this reproduction of some structural differences in our society. You know, by doing that, we're not really making education decisions. Now, I might make an education decision. I might make a decision of, you know, I just don't want my kid around when I do Zoom, and he doesn't like to sit in his room and do Zoom. And, you know, we have that decision to make. That's a very different decision. And so our teachers are having to make that decision. Our students are having to make that decision with their parents. And then the other part of this, you know, school story, which I don't think is fully recognized, is how difficult it really is to get this right, to be able to maintain social distancing, to be able to follow all the public health interventions, to actually be able to keep a bathroom clean with all the soap and you know, hand products and everything in them. So the school district is trying very hard to follow guidelines. I mean, I listened to a meeting this morning. They had a meeting yesterday afternoon. I was at one of the meetings a couple of weeks ago. I think they recognize this is a serious question, and they're putting a lot of work into building plans. But, you know, there's this like Mike Tyson quote that, you know, you work really hard playing a fight. Yeah, I'm quoting Mike Tyson. You work really hard playing a fight for about a year, and you walk onto the ring and you get punched and all those plans just go away, right? And that's kind of where this is. I mean, with all due respect to engineers, but if you have engineers develop, you know, the best plans based off CDC guidelines, as soon as you get back into a classroom of kids running around, those plans are, you know, you may as well throw them out the window because reality is going to hit really hard, that it's difficult to contact trace. And it's difficult to make decisions about what to do if a kid had symptoms or was tested positive. What are we going to do with that information, right? Are we going to close a classroom, not close a classroom? And, you know, on paper, these things sound very good. In reality, it's very difficult to do these. And so we have to have a little bit more time, I think, to be able to make a decision based on education, and then a little bit more time to really unfold how we're going to do these things as well from a process standpoint.
Dr. Jason Wilson with Tampa General Hospital on WMNF's Midpoint. At the risk of asking a personal question, what decision did you make when you contacted Hillsborough County Schools and they asked you if you wanted to send your son back to a brick and mortar school in the fall?
Sure. And this is, I want to just say for listeners, I don't think there was a right decision. So whether you picked what I picked or you picked the other decision, this is not medical advice, right? This is was a really tough personal decision where I think everybody has to show each other a lot of empathy around right now. But I did choose traditional schools, and I'll tell you why. It was almost like Las Vegas betting odds, honestly, the way I looked at it. So my kid really wanted me to choose that option. It's a big year for us because he moves from elementary school to middle school. And so, of course, that's a big social year in general. And so for a lot of those reasons, he was already anxious about the transition, right? And so now throw all this on top of it, and you've got, you know, kind of a dual layer of anxiety. And he's bored, right? And all those types of things that come with being an 11-year-old boy. So he advocated for that. So for me, of course, I very much struggled with this decision. And I struggled because, A, just to put this out there, you know, we know that kids don't seem to get as sick from this virus, which is great. That's one of the good pieces of information we have so far. But I want to make it clear that that's talking about a population health perspective. It doesn't mean we don't have kids who get sick from this virus. And so this world's going to look very different in Tampa if we get one kid who gets Kawasaki's, which is a very serious immune condition that can happen from this virus, which you can die from. If we have one case like that, it's going to look, A, for that family, it's going to be devastating, and B, for this area, it's going to be really difficult to contend with given the decisions we've made. So it's fine and good to say, look, my kid's risk is super low, he's healthy, and you know, even if he gets it, it's probably going to be a cold. And that is a true statement, but it doesn't mean it's 100%. And also, another part of that, of course, it doesn't mean that if he gets it, he's not going to give it to somebody else who, you know, either at that school or to a teacher, or to a teacher's family, or to a staff member, or to a kid who has vulnerable parents at home who he may play some role in some bad outcome for that family because he got it, or I may play some role because I let him go back to school. And you know, fortunately, it doesn't look like the virus spreads too much from kids my age back up intergenerationally back up to adults, but we don't know that for sure. We just saw a study come out of South Korea that demonstrated that you know, high school age students really do spread this virus quite a bit more than we thought they did before, even a higher, you know, older middle school and high school age students. And so this concept that we don't see any intergenerational spread is not true. We will see some. It just means it's less common than it is amongst adults. So there was that piece that really weighed on me. And of course, just from a public health standpoint, look, I don't go into any environment where where I sit with other people, you know, more than if I go into any physical environment right now, it's, you know, less than five people. Our hospital though mandates less than 10 people, mask wearing, you know, 6 feet apart. But for the most part, all of my administrative duties, if I'm not seeing patients, have been moved to Zooms and Teams and whatever other, you know, not trying to pick a brand, but whatever, you know, web platform, you know, so to do something different seemed a little hypocritical in many ways. But I'll tell you my what I meant by the Las Vegas thing, or the, you know, sort of probability thing, was that this was a binding agreement. Now I recognize the school's sort of background and said, look, if you've got an issue and you want to talk to us individually about you changing your plan, you probably can. But what was sent out to us was this was a binding 18-week agreement. And, you know, 18 weeks in COVID land is a lifetime right now. So data changes, what we know changes, and then, of course, our epidemiological curve changes too. And so we're having to make a decision for a really long period of time. So my thought process was that if I pick traditional, well, there's some chance that we look at the data this week, Thursday, next week, and we say, you know, the data really does not support opening traditional school. So then a school district or, you know, other leaders close the schools anyway. And so then we opt back to option B. So we had option A, we get put back in the option B bucket anyway. And then if things look better a month and a half, 2 months from now, if we get to a prevalence less than 5%, or we get to a new cases per day less than, you know, 5 or 10, well, and it's not 18 weeks out, at least I have that option, right, that we reopen and we're in the bucket that says you can go back. So I felt like it just gave us the best options at the time. But again, I don't think it was the right choice. And I don't think there was a right choice. I think it was not right to have to make this choice given where we are right now in the situation.
We're speaking with Dr. Jason Wilson, Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. And you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint on 88.5 FM. I'm going to go back in time a little bit to when most of the country, when Florida was under safer at home orders, and we were looking at the criteria to reopen. And I want to get your gauge on if we were making that decision today about reopening. I know it's a hypothetical, but I guess the reason I'm asking is because should we be reinstituting some of the safer at home measures based on things like, do we have sufficient contact tracing? Do we have declining numbers of infections? Do we have declining infection rate? And do we have sufficient testing? How would you rate Florida or Hillsborough County or the U.S. on a lot of those metrics?
Sure. So I think the lesson everyone's learned is the virus doesn't really want to follow your human calendar or your political will. It's going to do what it wants to do when it wants to do it. And so we did safer at home. We did a really good job of safer at home in March and April. I mean, really, I was shocked by how compliant and how reasonable people were and how much they wanted to participate in a community good. I think it said a lot about humans and human society that they were so willing to try to help each other out, especially when the message was consistent and clear amongst leaders that we just need to do this for a while and we would get through it. And you know, I think the problem was that if you really look at our numbers, we weren't really declining in the number of new cases per day for a trend long period of time. When you look at some of the European countries that have reopened, you really see long-term consistent declines in the number of new cases per day that then led to moving towards reopening. And I'm not sure we really saw that. Again, it's kind of like making a school decision right now. We're seeing data that looks concerning, but we're making a decision right now about doing something, you know, different than what the data shows. And I think that's probably for the most part how we did your return from safer at home. The other big issue is we didn't have a mass debate while we were locked down or instead of doing safer at home. We had a mass debate 2 months into return. And I think, unfortunately, that the cat was out of the bag or whatever analogy you want to use there, that was a way too late discussion to have. If we could have really had a discussion about that in March and April that said, listen, we all want to get out of our houses. We would all like to do something different than just sit here and stare at Zoom all day. But to do that, we're going to have to agree on a few things. We're going to have to discuss, you know, freedoms here, which freedoms are very important to us. So if we would like to get out of this, and we'd like to get out of this and stay out of this, we don't have to go back to it, we should probably agree we're going to wear masks. Because by mid-April, we're starting to see data that's pretty clear at that point that the countries that We're already mask wearers. First of all, that's one thing people forget is there are countries that wear masks fairly routinely anyway. So you take those countries, a lot of Southeast Asian countries, and you take those countries, they were already mask wearers, or they're easy adopters to mask wearing because it was part of their kind of cultural thing they do anyway. Those countries really have very, very low rates. And then we started to see some data from New England Journal, other places, just showing aerosolized particles hitting cloth masks and showing, wow, these actually work probably better than we thought they did. Okay, so let's have this discussion that if we're going to reopen, we're probably going to need to wear masks. Get that discussion going and get it over with. And then along with that discussion comes some other difficult discussions we're going to probably have to have. Well, we want to get out of our houses, but to do that, we're probably going to need to give up a little bit of privacy. Because if we want to do this safely and keep our prevalence low, less than 5%, which remember, it's 2% of the time. We're in pretty good shape at the time. But to keep it there, we're going to be really aggressive about contact tracing, like South Korea level aggressive. You know, South Korea, they had the same case the same day we did, right? They had their first case really the same time as the United States. And they went like this and totally flattened and annihilated. They did more than flatten the curve. They annihilated the curve. And, you know, they did that because if you are in South Korea and you go to a restaurant or a bar and someone tests positive for COVID who was at that restaurant or bar with you, you get an alert on your phone. And it says, you were at this GPS location bar between this time and this time. Someone else was there between this time and this time that had a positive test. Now, look, I recognize that there's a lot of ramifications about personal liberties there. But again, our society is based on trade-offs of liberties. That's the whole point of a democracy like ours, that we say, well, I want to get out of my house. So if this is what it's going to take to keep me out of my house, then maybe I'm willing to do this for a while until the prevalence gets to 0.25% or something. We didn't do that. We didn't do contact tracing. We didn't do mask wearing. And then we also accelerated movement in from phase one into phase two, again, with that same conversation lacking, which was, are we really seeing consistent declines in the incidence rate of new cases per day? And if we want to be really true to that data, are we fitting the next step in this? And, you know, this is where I think all of us could have done a better job maybe of talking to business and talking to our economic leaders that it's going to be a lot easier to maintain a little bit longer of a punch than it is going to be to try to get out of the ring for a second and get punched again and punched again and punched again. And there's actually economic data demonstrating this is 100% true now. You know, Sweden did not benefit economically by not doing a safer at home. Other countries that have done safer at homes, more aggressive than they have, and have less economic hits than we've had. And that data is out there now too. And so, you know, we could probably sustain this a little bit longer. And what's interesting is the public speaks too, you know, and it's not just official political positions or official government policies. The public speaks out of fear as well. And, you know, what we've seen recently, which is very interesting, is Walmart has now mandated masks, recognized their customers are scared to come there. Maybe they're concerned about some liability if a customer gets COVID from there and has a bad outcome. So we've seen that in the market too. People, OpenTable tracks restaurant reservations, and we see that right around, we see the peaks of our testing, we see those reservations go down for restaurants too. We saw that in Houston and in Tampa. And so, you know, people speak as well. So, you know, the concern, of course, right now on the table is, do we have to roll back a little bit? And this is a discussion we should be having between the EPG and the school board, because if the biggest priority you have in this area, if you want to say the biggest priority you have is to reopen brick and mortar schools by August 31st, which by the way is not necessarily the local priority, but it's a state given priority because of a federal given discussion that's happening. But if that's where you're at, you feel that you have to reopen by August 31st, then we should be doing everything as a community to support that decision, right? In terms of what we have to do to make that a safe decision. And the only way we make that a safe decision would be to, right this very moment, completely change our public health approach to this virus, which would probably mean much more aggressive measures for social distancing and mitigation of virus, and probably staying home a little bit more.
We're speaking with Dr. Jason Wilson, Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. This is WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM Tampa. So let's talk now about a little bit more about testing. Florida was pretty slow to ramp up testing. There was a shortage of test kits at first, it seems, or at least of equipment. And now we're seeing a lot more testing, but there's log jams with long lines and people being turned away. How can we get our testing more efficient to get everyone tested who wants to be tested?
Yeah, so what we're seeing right now is different than what we saw early. What we saw early was a problem with supplies. And that problem with supplies was worsened because a lot of the supplies, the nasopharyngeal swabs, actually come from a laboratory or a manufacturer, I should say, a manufacturer in Italy. And of course, Italy was being ravaged in the early spring. There was also an earthquake in the same city of Italy that these swabs were made in the early spring. And so supply chains were completely disrupted, which then lessened the amount of these test kits that were able to get to us safely. Some of us made our own test kits. The FDA actually allowed us to make our own test kits, which was, that's a big thing for the FDA. They're very strict about testing, diagnostic testing, but they actually put out guidance. It's called an expanded use authorization, EUA, which is how a lot of things are under COVID right now, but put out guidance that you could basically make up your own test as long as it fits some certain guidelines. And through USF and Tampa General in a partnership, we made some of these 3D printed swabs and our own viral transport medium. And that's what a test kit is. It's a swab and a medium that the swab can live in so that you can run the sample later. And so we were able to make some of those to withstand that gap time, but that's just one hospital, right? And so what are all the other places doing? Well, that means that basically your commercial labs don't have kits available to sell or to provide. Your other private, you know, entities don't have these kits and available. So eventually that faucet kind of turned back up. And so more kits started coming into the market. More kits became available. And I'm really talking right now about the PCR diagnostic test, not the antibody test. That's a separate, sort of a separate discussion. But we think about the gold standard now, or the acute part of the reaction to diagnose a patient as the PCR test, and which is true for a lot of viruses now. So that's what we should concentrate on here. And so that faucet got turned back up by early summer or late spring. And so then we started seeing enough kits become available. But the problem with that is, well, who's going to run the test? And so a big hospital like Tampa General is an academic place and it's got a huge lab in it. We can run tests, but we can only run so many a day, right? There's going to be some capacity we hit at some point. And to keep our hospital safe and to keep elective surgeries going, we decided to start testing really everyone who walked into the hospital. And so that's hundreds of tests a day we were doing. Every ER patient, every patient got admitted, every elective surgery patient, pre-screening for surgeries. So that started to take up the capacity for Tampa General. So you start looking for the county and the private labs. Well, the county has a lab and they send them to the state too, but you know, that capacity is very limited, you know, compared to a private lab or to a big academic lab. So then the players in the private lab space, there's really only two. There's a company called LabCorp and there's a company called Quest. And they're the big players, and they're the big players nationally. And so what quickly happens is that even though your private entity or your county site or your other testing site can offer the actual physical test, stick a swab in your nose and get the sample, they send them off to LabCorp or Quest. And then what we've now seen is that LabCorp or Quest have these huge queues to get the test run. So the test only takes 4 or 5 hours to actually physically put on the machine and let it kind of, you know, run. Now we're seeing 5-day days sometimes for turnaround time for these tests, which of course the whole point of testing is to try to know where virus is at and who has virus so we can isolate the right people, contact trace, recognize our current state of affairs quickly and act on it. And, you know, by 5 to 8 days, isn't even relevant information anymore. Has the virus totally shifted to where it's actually at? We're looking at the runner at the starting line. He's already at the finish.
Our guest is Jason Wilson, Medical Director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. What do we know about immunity for people who have been infected with coronavirus? Can they be reinfected?
Yeah, so two important conversations to have around immunity. Three important things to talk about around immunity. One is, can you be reinfected? Do you actually have immunity if you've been infected? Two is herd immunity a strategy we can talk about from a public health standpoint? And three are vaccinations. And so for the first part of things, if we talk about just the whole idea is, if I get infected with a virus or any other type of pathogen, my body recognizes it and forms antibody against it. So the next time I have it, I already have antibody for it. And so it doesn't mean I won't get a little bit sick, but I probably won't get nearly as sick as I did that first time where I had no way to fight it. And so I'm able to produce antibody to fight virus. Well, we know that the body is doing that some. That's actually the underlying science behind convalescent plasma therapy. In that domain of therapy, what we're doing is we're taking people who recover from COVID, testing them for antibody. If they have antibody present, we ask them for their plasma. They donate their plasma, and we basically give that blood to another person who's currently has COVID and has no antibody against it. So we do know that we have seen antibody against COVID, and we are getting donors, which is great because that's helping other patients. The concern we see, though, is that if you take a patient who's had COVID and you test their antibody 10 days after they had COVID, it may be reasonably high. First of all, it's not super high, which is the first signal of concern. We would like to see that antibody 10 days out be very high. Like, it should be like flashing at you, like, hey, this guy just had COVID and, you know, he was sick. But it's like, it's kind of high. And then what's even more concerning, though, is that 3 months later, we're seeing data now that basically shows antibody levels are falling much lower. And that becomes a question of, well, how much protection are you really going to have if you get this again? You probably still have some, but it's probably not what we want to see to talk about you being basically unaffected by this in the future. And it does seem to relate to how sick you were. So sicker people seem to produce more antibody, and it seems to that signal seems to last longer. So a lot of unknowns there. The second thing is, you know, herd immunity. People talk about herd immunity. If we could just get everybody to get the virus, all these young people to get the virus for us, basically, you don't have no other medical problems, could we just reach herd immunity? Well, just to give people an idea around herd immunity, to get to that level of herd immunity, you'd probably need about 60% of the population to have encountered this virus, which is a huge number. And so someone's going to say, well, yeah, but if you take a bunch of young people and 60% of them get it, and the case fatality rate's, you know, 10 times less than what you measure, because a lot of people get the virus don't test, right? It's underreported. So that case fatality rate, they're going to do fine. But the problem there is that, A, if we're seeing the struggles we're seeing now, based on this tiny prevalence that we have right now, people who have virus at any given time, imagine what would happen to your hospital systems if you tried to reach that. Imagine what would happen to even just those young people if you multiply out that case fatality rate against that huge number. A small percent of a big number is a really big number. And also to get there, it's not possible, just you look at the census, it's not possible demographically get there unless some vulnerable, sicker people get there as well. So the number of lives we would lose just from the virus itself would be incredible, but also that surge I talked about earlier, we're trying to dampen down that case fatality rate surge, dampen down that surge to our hospitals. If we did that, we would overwhelm things drastically and we'd see that case fatality rate spike. And so that leaves us with, well, hopefully a vaccine at some point is able to do this. And, you know, there's probably about a dozen vaccine trials that are all really ongoing right now, and some of them have been moving into phase 3, which is the true clinical immunogenic test phase, clinical phase of a trial. Those are great. That's great that's happening. The only, I always remind people that we've been looking for an HIV vaccine for the last, you know, 30 years. We've been looking for a RSV vaccine for infants for, you know, for a very long time as well. I'm glad to see these vaccine trials are moving, because that's probably our best chance at gathering some large population immunity. But we should understand we might be in this for the long haul in terms of having to kind of find ways to live with this virus and do it safely as well.
Well, Dr. Jason Wilson, I want to thank you so much for coming on WMNF. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, that was Dr. Jason Wilson. He is medical director of the clinical depression, the clinical decision unit, that is, at Tampa General Hospital. I spoke to him last week. You're listening to WMNF Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. It's 12:53 in the afternoon, and we're going to take your calls the rest of the show. Here's how you can join in. The phone lines should be open right now if you call 813-239-9663. You can also email your questions or comments to dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Please put your name on the text. And I want to know what you thought about what he said. One of the most important questions we have this summer is whether it's safe to send kids and teachers back to in-person schools in a few weeks. So I want to know your thoughts about that. 813-239-9663. And I should say on that, in that vein, there's another protest tomorrow in Pinellas. Pinellas County School employees, parents, students, and community members will rally again tomorrow to demand when schools start next month that they begin online. And they want to return to in-person instruction only after the county has gone 14 days with no new coronavirus infections. The rally is at 4:30 tomorrow afternoon in front of the Pinellas County School Board Administration Building. And if you want to find out more about that, 2 weeks ago on Midpoint Monday, I interviewed a teacher who is helping to organize those rallies. And so you can find that on our website, WMNF.org. Well, we're taking your phone calls and your emails right now about the interview we just did, that I just did with Dr. Jason Wilson, who's medical director of the Clinical Decision Unit at Tampa General Hospital. And some of the other things that he talked about that we could definitely converse about in this conversation is that how the coronavirus numbers are trending. We're still seeing rising numbers in Florida. And whether there's a chance that we could gain herd immunity to COVID-19, I wonder what you think about what he was saying and about the Sweden model versus some of the other European models. And just a reminder that at the top of the show that I mentioned that Florida has recorded more than 6,000 coronavirus deaths now. The state health department reported another 76 deaths today, bringing the number of people in Florida who have died of the coronavirus since March 1st to nearly 6,050. And more than a third of that number have been during just this month of July, just during the last 3.5 weeks or so. And the state recorded almost 8,900 new confirmed cases today, bringing the total to almost 424,000. There are only a handful of countries in the world that have more cases of coronavirus than Florida. The positivity rate for tests over the last 7 days is 19%. And again, during that conversation, we heard that 5% or below is where we should be if we want to reopen the state. Well, the state's already reopened, but we're at 19% positive, which is a very, very high positivity rate. And it's been at that rate for about 3 weeks. Now, the number of cases every day hasn't set a record for a few days. So that might be a sign that there's some sort of leveling off in the number of new cases every day. But other things lag behind that, like the number of deaths. If you look at the trend lines, the curves, number of deaths trails by about a month, the number of cases, the spike in cases. So that would seem to indicate that for the next month, we might see a climbing death rates in Florida, which is scary because we've already recorded more than 6,000 coronavirus deaths in Florida. I just want to remind you that you're listening to WMNF Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan, and you can call in 813-239-9663, or you can email dj@wmnf.org. Karen wrote in from Dunedin and said, unfortunately, I think people's resolve is slipping further, especially into this pandemic, which the further we go into this pandemic, which makes no sense because the numbers are just increasing. So that's what Karen out there in Dunedin says, getting to the fact that I think that some people would be really disrupted if we have to go back into a lockdown. And this was mentioned by a caller during the last show, but a Major League Baseball game that was scheduled for Miami has been postponed because of a coronavirus outbreak among the Miami Marlins team. And they were playing in Philadelphia the last few days. So the next series between the Yankees and Philly is also postponed because of the threats of coronavirus there. And if you want to talk about something besides coronavirus, we can also talk about the protests, for example, in Portland. And this month, where a senior National Guard officer, this was last month, a senior National Guard officer says the U.S. Park Police began the violent clearing of protesters from Lafayette Square last month without apparent provocation or adequate warning. Army National Guard Commander Adam DeMarco's account challenges key aspects of the Trump administration's explanation for the clearing of the protest just before President Trump walked through the area in front of the White House for a photo opportunity. DeMarco's statement was in prepared testimony ahead of a hearing tomorrow by the House Natural Resources Committee. The Trump administration says attacks by protesters warranted the use of force. DeMarco says it appeared the protest was peaceful. So that's another thing we could talk about in the minute or so we have remaining. 813-239-9663. And let me read this story out of Portland that Rob touched on last hour as well. A peaceful protest morphed into an intense early morning confrontation between demonstrators and law enforcement in Oregon's largest city. U.S. agents fired what appeared to be tear gas, flashbangs, and pepper balls early today to clear a mass of protesters outside the federal courthouse in Portland. Some protesters had climbed over the fence that surrounded the courthouse. Other shots Other people shot fireworks, they banged onto the fence and projected lights onto the building. The city has seen nightly protests for 2 months since the death of George Floyd. Yesterday, Portland police say a person was shot in a park near where the protests take place. A bag was also found containing loaded rifle magazines and Molotov cocktails. Well, I don't think I have time to go to the phone right now. We only have a few seconds left, but I do want to thank Rob Lori, Frank Knox, and DT for their help with the show today. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Bureau, will be back to host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned right now for Latino 54. That's coming up in 5 minutes after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. I want to thank everyone for listening, and thank you for supporting WMNF.org.